Intelligent promotion. Ralph Waldo Emerson said that if you made a better mousetrap than your neighbor, the world would beat a pathway to your door. That statement may have been valid at one time, but today it is no longer true. For no matter how good your particular mousetrap may be, there won't be any big rush toward your place of business until three major points have been stressed. You, the mousetrap, and your location. All three must be properly promoted. Intelligent promotion, either by yourself or someone else with your interests at heart, is an all-important prelude to selling. By promotion, I don't mean advertising, although good advertising is sometimes part of an overall promotion plan. Intelligent and effective promotion stimulates curiosity and creates a receptive climate in which you can sell yourself. World history contains countless incidents in which good promotion preceded successful selling. Julius Caesar and his battle-weary legions were encamped beside a small river between Italy and Gaul. Selected couriers, not soldiers, were sent ahead to the capital city of Rome. There they mingled with both the aristocrats and the common people. Over and over again, the couriers told the same story. Caesar's army, encamped a few miles away, was the greatest fighting force ever assembled. It was overpowering, invincible. In his camp, Caesar waited patiently until the messengers returned. He waited until he knew that the idea of his power and strength was firmly implanted in the mind of every man and woman in Rome. Then, and only then, did he cross the Rubicon and begin to sell the idea of a Roman Empire. Napoleon used the same tactics. Stories of his extraordinary ability and military genius to prepare the French nation for his emergence as their leader. In 18th century England, a physician named Edward Jenner was convinced that immunization for the scourge of smallpox lay in a simple inoculation of cowpox. No one believed him, and no one would volunteer as a test patient. Dr. Jenner promoted his idea through stories of milkmaids who, because they had contracted cowpox, were safe and immune to the more lethal disease of smallpox. Consequently, when a small boy became dangerously ill, his parents were willing to try the new Jenner inoculation. Thus, one of the most progressive steps in modern medicine was sold by a subtle prelude of promotion. Recognizable campaigns of consistent promotion are more common in the modern world of show business. Producers, directors, and managers select actors and performers for two reasons. First, their talent. Second, their stature at the box office. It is this important second consideration, the ability to draw paying customers into a theater, that is built by promotion. Keeping those same customers satisfied and coming back depends on each actor's ability to sell himself. Every medium of communication, newspapers, magazines, radio, and television, is used to publicize and promote current stars and future stars. The more that is known about a personality, preferably favorable facts, the more valuable his talent and services become. Admittedly, the average person who wants to promote himself is not a John Wayne, Marlon Brando, or Jane Fonda, or any other motion picture star. Nor is a high-priced promotion staff available. But Julius Caesar, Napoleon Bonaparte, or Dr. Edward Jenner didn't have one either. They merely recognized an important fact. It would be easier to sell themselves and their ideas if some favorable stories were circulated. During the first decade of this century in Chicago, a young lawyer named Paul Harris conceived the brilliant idea of circumventing the rule against a lawyer advertising. He formed a group of 25 or 30 of his business friends and organized the first Rotary Club. His idea was to promote himself into a variety of contacts which might conceivably be converted into clients as the result of his personal relationship with them during lunch once a week. Today, the Rotary Club movement has spread all over the world and has become an international power for good. And naturally, the idea did its founder no harm. Certainly, if we wish to get ahead, we must find ways and means of bringing ourselves to the attention of people who need whatever we have to offer the world. Building a better mousetrap than your neighbor will mean very little unless sound, intense, and continuous sales promotion is placed back of the trap.
How many of you know I've heard Earl Nightingale's program? How many? Oh, my. Earl has some friends here, too. I had one of the most joyous visits with Earl Nightingale about a year ago that I've ever had with anybody in Chicago in recent years. He sat down and he told me a most dramatic story about what happened when he got a hold of my philosophy. He was working along at an ordinary salary, not getting anywhere, and very discouraged. When somebody put a copy of one of my books in his hand and he went to bed and started reading it in bed. And all of a sudden, he got an idea out of that book that caused him to yell to his wife to come quickly and found it. And she ran in, thought something had happened, sure enough. And she said, "You found what?" "Why," he said, "I have found what I have been looking for so long. I found the thing that's standing between me and success." He said, "I went down the next day, and I made up my mind I was going to put Napoleon Hill and his philosophy to a test. I made up my mind I was going to double my salary and going to do it that week. Easiest thing I ever did in my life. I only had to ask and it was done." That almost scared me. I waited a little while and I thought I'd try it again just to see if that wasn't a coincidence. And it worked again! Well, Earl doesn't have to worry now about raising his own salary. He's doing all right. He's on top. He's doing a grand job. He's found himself. He's got his mind on the things he wants in life and not on the things he doesn't want. And ladies and gentlemen, that's all any of us need. You know, it's not more knowledge. It's not more education we need. It's not more facts. It's a better use of what we already have that we need to have. You have each and every one of you within your own potential powers now. You have everything necessary to do a wonderful job in your own chosen field if you would only embrace it and use it. Did you know, ladies and gentlemen, that when we are born, when we come over to this plane, we bring with us two sealed envelopes. In one of those sealed envelopes is a long list of the rewards and riches you may have for taking possession of your own mind and using it. And in another sealed envelope, an equally long list of the penalties you must pay if you don't embrace your own mind and use it. The Creator didn't intend for men to be in possession of this marvelous, profound gift of thought without using it. And as some philosopher said, I wish I had said it, but I didn't. Whatever it is that you have, you use it or you lose it. And that's just as applicable to your brain power, to your thinking power, as it is to anything else. You use it or you lose it.
Persistence is the keynote of success for all great leaders. Furthermore, one of the outstanding qualities of leaders is the ability to so organize their plans that they are free at all times to place the weight of their personal effort wherever it is most needed. An efficient leader is not necessarily the person who appears to be the busiest. A leader is the person who can so organize plans that large numbers of other people can be efficiently directed and kept busy. The person who can get things done is much more profitable to a business firm than the person who actually does the work.
Take Charles M. Schwab, for instance. He was the right-hand man of the distinguished Andrew Carnegie. And he rose to a position of great importance as president of the United States Steel Corporation. His salary was $75,000 a year, And on some occasions, at the end of the year, Mr. Carnegie gave him a bonus of as much as $1 million a year, more than 10 times as much as he received a salary. And when I asked Mr. Carnegie if he felt that he had to give Mr. Schwab that amount of money, he said, no, I didn't have to. I could have neglected it and let him go across the street and go into competition with me. And then, seriously speaking, he said, I paid Mr. Schwab $75,000 a year for what he did. I gave him a bonus at the end of the year of as much as $1 million for what he got other people to do. And he was a past master at inspiring other people to cooperate. $1 million personality.
There is a mistaken notion in the world to the effect that people are paid for what they know. This idea is only partially true, and like all other half-truths, it does more damage than a brazen falsehood. The truth is, people are paid not merely for what they know, but more particularly for what they do with what they know. Successful people never wait for others to show them what to do or how to do it. They take the initiative themselves, enlist the necessary assistance, and forge ahead. All great leaders understand successful selling, and all sales strategists are great leaders. They understand the art of persuasion. They can establish powerful motives in the minds of their associates, which will induce willing cooperation. Sales strategists can sell anything they choose to sell because they have sufficient initiative to create markets. Moreover, they can sell one product, idea, plan, or service just as easily as any other. Great leaders and great salespeople use the same philosophy. They sell their customers or associates whatever they choose to sell because they first establish a pleasant relationship of confidence. They are, in truth, selling their way through life.
I had an opportunity to demonstrate the practicability of this philosophy before I was 21 years of age. I married and went down to the little town of Lumberport, West Virginia, to visit my in-laws. They had never seen me, and my wife took me down to show me off. And before we left Washington, I bought myself a nice outfit of clothes, got ready to make a good impression. But when we got down to Lumberport, or rather to Haywood, 2 miles from Lumberport, where the interurban electric line stops, where you're supposed to be met by a horse-drawn carriage, it was raining hard and there was no carriage, and I had to walk over those 2 miles and carry 2 suitcases. And when I got over there, my nice outfit of clothes was spoiled and also my disposition. That was very fortunate, because what happened enabled me to make what turned out to be worth very much more than $1 million, and I did it in less than 6 months, by my first application of the Carnegie philosophy. I said to my brothers-in-law, why don't you have the streetcar company build a spur line over here so you can get in and out of Lumberport without wading in the mud? They said, well, did you see that big Monongahela River over there that you just crossed? I said, yes. He said, that's the reason why we don't do it. He said, we've been trying for 10 years to get a streetcar built over here, and we can't get one. I said, 10 years? Well, I can do it in 6 months. One of them said, that's fine, and we really have got somebody in the family now, haven't we? The rain had stopped by that time, and I asked my brothers-in-law to walk over to this river that was giving the trouble, and they told me that it cost $100,000 to build a bridge across that river, and that was more than the streetcar company is willing to put in the entire project. I was standing there, kind of stalling for a way out of that unfortunate misuse of my tongue. And here was a description of the river. The river, the banks of the river are about 100 feet high, and the county road went zigzagging down this side of the bank across a little rickety bridge and up the other side of the bank, and then across about 14 railroad switching tracks. It was a place where there'd be no railroad coming and made up their coal trains. And while I was standing there, as is so often the case in an emergency, that man that stood looking over my shoulder, that silent person that stood there so many times, whispered in my ear, said, you see that farmer down there that's waiting for that coal train to... A train had come along and blocked the highway. And I said to myself, yes, I see that, and I also see the solution. I see three parties that want this bridge. The B&O Railroad Company wants that county road off of their tracks because some of these days they're going to have an accident there that'll cost them many times the cost of the bridge. The county commissioners want the county road over there for the same reason, and the streetcar company want it over there because they like to have some extra revenue coming out of Lumberport. Inside of a week's time, I had the names of the three parties, the B&O Railroad Company, the county commissioners, and the street railway company on a dotted line. And at the end of the 6 months period, I rode the first streetcar into Lumberport that ever went into that town. Sometime later in 1934, I rode the last one out when they took up those tracks and supplanted them with the buses. Mr. Carnegie taught me how to make this philosophy cause you to become resourceful in a time of an emergency. And I want to tell you that I think that's one of the finest things that it does. When you're up against a stone wall, when you've exhausted all of your intelligence and all of your experience, when you've done everything, then this philosophy seems to come to the rescue and give you the answer. And I've seen it happen so many times, it's not funny anymore. In this very city, shortly after I came here, I met Edwin C. Barnes, the only partner that Thomas A. Edison ever had. And he was telling me about his association with Mr. Edison. He was telling me how he went up to West Orange, New Jersey, and on a freight train because he didn't have money to pay his way, and sold Edison on taking him into partnership with him. How he had stood by for 5 years in one menial job after another, waiting for the opportunity to come when he could become a partner of the great Edison. And then he said something to me that I thought was in the way of boasting. He said, "Well, now I'm doing all right," said, "I'm making over $12,000 a year." I said, $12,000 a year? If I were the partner of the great Edison, I'd be making at least $50,000 a year. And he said, "How?" Had you ever thought of the importance of that word "how" when somebody's making a statement that you don't have, you don't believe exactly can be backed up? Had you ever tried out using that word "how"? Oh, I've seen them wiggle and squirm when that word was shot at them at the right time. And I did a little wiggling and squirming when Ed Barnes said, "How?" Well, then I became serious. I started in to apply the Carnegie philosophy. I started to ask questions. And by the time we were through eating, I had the plan that did the trick. I had Ed Barnes form an exchange bureau made up of all of his salesmen and all of the salesmen of the typewriter companies, the salesmen of office supplies and desks in and near the Chicago territory. And through this bureau, when one of Barnes's men selling the Edison dictating machine would find somebody who needed a desk or office supplies, he'd phone it into the bureau and the bureau would transfer it over to the right salesman. And the salesman in that field, when they heard of somebody who wanted a dictating machine, they'd phone into the bureau and Barnes's men would get it. In other words, Barnes had in a little while about 150 salesmen giving him good leads and prospects without having to pay them anything. It was something like during World War Number One, the price of fur became very high, and a very shrewd German friend of mine up in Milwaukee started a cat farm. Well, he ran into a problem right away. He found out feed was also high. But being a student of this philosophy, he was shrewd enough to solve that problem too. He started a rat farm right along by the side of the cat farm. He fed the rats over to the cats, then he skinned the cats and fed the part of the carcasses back to the rats, and that way he didn't have any feed bill anymore. Well, my plan for Barnes was something like that. He had no expense. First year after that happened, his income was over $50,000. The second one over $100,000. The third one $150,000. And after that, I never did get the figures. And he owes it all to this philosophy. Every bit of it.
Concentration. The ability to focus your attention, interest, and desire upon the attainment of a definite end is of major importance if you want to sell your way through life. Every human being makes use of the principle of concentration, whether it is realized or not. The person who permits the conscious mind to dwell upon the negative thoughts of fear, poverty, ill health, and intolerance thereby applies the law of concentration, and sooner or later, the subconscious mind will pick up these suggestions, act upon them, and translate them into their physical counterparts. Concentration is also defined as the habit of planting in the mind a definite aim, object, or purpose, and visualizing the same until ways and means for its realization have been created. The principle of concentration, as it applies to selling your way through life, means planting in your conscious mind a definite chief aim, idea, plan, or purpose, and the continuous focusing upon it. Concentration is also the medium by which procrastination is overcome. The same principle is the foundation upon which both self-confidence and self-control are predicated. The principle of habit goes hand in glove with concentration. Habit may come from concentration, or concentration evolved from habit. In either case, the object of concentrating upon a definite aim is to train the mind until it forms the habit of focusing upon the object of that aim.
The law of cosmic habit force is the comptroller of the natural laws of this universe, the shaper and the maker of all habits. And one of the queer things about man is that he is the only creature upon the face of this earth who has been given the power to break the hold of cosmic habit force and make his own habits what he wants them to be. Every other creature, lower in intelligence than that of man, comes into this world plane bound by a pattern it can never break out of, a pattern called instinct. Man makes his own patterns. He can declare his own destiny. He can shape his own future. He can make his own job. I think if there was ever a time in this country when men and women need to recognize the power of their own minds, when they need to overcome frustration and fear, that time is now. There is too much fear spread around. Too many people talking about depressions. We're trying very hard to see if we can't work ourselves into a depression, or if we can't work ourselves into another world war. Let's get our mind, each and every one of us as individuals, fixed upon a definite goal so big and so outstanding that we'll have no time to think about these things we don't want. Do you know one of the queer things about mankind consists in the fact that the vast majority of people are born, grow up, struggle, go through life as misery and in failure, never getting out of life what they want, not recognizing that it would be just as easy, by the turn of a hand, so to speak, to switch over and get out of life exactly what they want, not recognizing that the mind attracts the thing that the mind dwells upon. You can think about poverty, you can think about failure, you can think about defeat, and that's exactly what you'll get. You can think about success, you can think about opulence, you can think about achievement, and that's what you'll get. I want to tell you that the most difficult period of my life was in those 20 years between 1908 and 1928, when I had to give myself mental and spiritual immunity against the people who were saying, you can't do it, it can't be done, you'll never live long enough. At least half of my energy went to resisting the people who thought it couldn't be done.
Here are a few suggestions on how to develop and apply your powers of concentration. First, establish the habit of giving orders to your subconscious mind. Repeat the orders over and over again. Keep up this procedure until you get satisfactory results. Remember, eternal vigilance is the price of mastery. Second, empty your conscious mind of all other thoughts. After a little practice, you will be able to focus your mind entirely upon any subject you please. Third, hold your thought to the object of your concentration with a burning desire for the attainment of whatever object you have in mind. When you concentrate upon your definite chief aim, do so in perfect faith that you will realize the object of that aim. Fourth, when you find your conscious mind wandering, drive it back, focusing upon the subject, until you have developed such perfect self-control that you can keep all other thoughts out of your mind. Mix emotions or feeling with your thoughts when concentrating. Otherwise, they will not be recognized by your subconscious mind. Fifth, as a general rule, concentration can be best applied when you're in an environment of silence. Private periods of relaxation during the day or after you have retired at night are probably the best times for concentration. Sixth and finally, remember this. Your subconscious mind can best be reached and influenced when you concentrate in your conscious mind upon an idea, plan, or purpose in a spirit of intense enthusiasm. The reason is simple. Enthusiasm arouses your faculty of creative imagination and puts it into action. Merely permitting a definite aim to enter your mind is in no way beneficial. Such an aim, to be of permanent value, must be fixed in your mind through concentration. Concentration develops the power of persistence and enables you to master all forms of temporary defeat. The majority of people never learn the real difference between temporary defeat and permanent failure because they lack the persistence to stage a comeback after temporary defeat.
Failure, fear, physical pain, and all other forms of adversity carry with them the seed of an equivalent or a greater benefit. Physical pain is the common language of nature in which she speaks to all living creatures and teaches them many things they would not learn in any other way. Failure and defeat have been known to turn people back from chosen purposes which, had they been attained, would have led to destruction. Remember the next time you meet with any sort of adversity that it contains the seeds of an equivalent or a greater benefit. But you must find that seed and germinate it into growth in your behalf through constructive thinking and positive action. Every circumstance affecting your life can be turned to a benefit by your mental attitude toward it. Adversity. I think I can tell you, had it not been for the many adversities which I experienced in the early part of my work with Andrew Carnegie, I never would have completed the Science of Personal Achievement. I had adversity after adversity, but I learned to transmute those adversities into something constructive and to come up with something that would take the place of an adversity. Every time I failed, I said, well, this is just another opportunity that I have to prove that my philosophy can take care of the situation of failure. I learned to transmute all failures into successes. I also learned the difference between temporary defeat and failure. Most people accept defeat as permanent failure. Defeat is never failure. No circumstance is ever failure until it is accepted by the individual as such. And that's one of the greatest things that I learned about this principle of profiting by adversity.
In the final analysis, persistence is nothing more than concentrated effort mixed with determination and faith. Every human being is ruled by the law of habit. Because this is true, the person who learns to build his habits to order controls the major cause of successful achievement. It has been truly said, we first make our habits, and our habits then make us. There are habits of mind and habits of body. Both are subject to control. And the medium of that control is concentration. Through concentration, you can force your mind to dwell upon any subject you wish, and through habit, it will follow that course automatically. There is no point of compromise between people and their habits. Either they control their habits, or their habits control them. Consequently, people who are successful force themselves to build the kind of habits by which they are willing to be controlled. Your financial condition is not the result of chance or accident. It reflects perfectly the nature of your dominating thoughts, desires, and aims. For the person who understands the infinite possibilities of concentration need never know the word impossible.
Back some years ago, a group of my students, on my birthday, got together a fund and bought me a nice dictionary, a nice large one. And the first thing I did, they rolled it out on the stage and gave it to me with a formal presentation. I took out my penknife and walked over and I said, ladies and gentlemen, I thank you for your thoughtfulness, but I can't accept that book with one word that's in it because that one word is very offensive to me. And I turned over to the word impossible and clipped it right out. And I said, now I'll accept the book, but I don't want any book that has the word impossible in it, because I've seen the impossible happen so many times that I know there is no such thing.
Thank you.